The following Dahmer discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, Bodhisattvas. It's very nice to be here. I was mentioning to Arjun Sensei this morning that earlier in the week I wrote a talk for this morning and didn't quite sit right. So I wrote another talk and we'll just see what happens. I wanted to, I was thinking about you and being here in this place, in this city, and this time. I was listening to an interview with John Stewart and Heather Cox, who's has become kind of a superstar historian, which is interesting in and of itself. And after reflecting on and seeing patterns in history and what's going on today, at the end he said, "What should we do?" And she was a little bit flummoxed because that's not really what historians do. But I thought the question was very heartfelt, and it's a question that we're asked, what do we do? What do I do now? What do we do now? And one of the things I've always appreciated about Buddhism, it doesn't actually answer that question. It doesn't give you that answer. How could it? The Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, different time, different country, different language, different culture. Sometimes people would ask Dada Roshi, what are we going to do in 10 years and 15 years? He goes, I don't predict the future. Buddhism doesn't tell us what to do. It can't. That's our job. But it introduces us to our mind. The Buddha realized if we want to understand the world, we have to understand our mind. That's how he defined the world. It's your senses. It's what you see. It's what you perceive. It's what you do with what you perceive. It's asking the question, is what I'm perceiving, how much in accord is that with what is actually happening? How much of it is my projection, my wish, my desire, my denial? Shanti Davis said, if something can be remedied, why be unhappy about it? If there's no remedy for it, still, there's no point in being unhappy. Other translation frames it in terms of worry. If there's something you can do, don't worry. If there's nothing you can do, don't worry. What's his point? Worry is extra, is something secondary, something else that we bring in. If there's something we can do, that's what we can do. That's what we should do. Worry does not help. It actually hinders. If there's nothing we can do to recognize that, then what is the point of worrying? Shanti Davis also says, people do not want suffering, criticism, harsh words, or anything unpleasant for themselves or their friends. But for their enemies, it can be the opposite. So we have recently had this election, which was a moment in time, which in a sense the last some hundreds of years has been leading up to, maybe thousands of years. It's not just one moment in time. And so riding the waves of society and culture and governments and technology and history and movements that rise and fall, come and go. The Buddha said everything is in a state of change. It's the one constant. It's the one permanent thing is change itself. How do we live in this world, our world, the one we've been given at this time? Because this is the only real thing. This is the only true thing. One of the Buddha's most profound enlightenments was what he described as dependent origination. That anything that you can perceive, which is everything, everything we call our world, inside and outside, arises through a process, you could say. of karmic actions and conditions. There are conditions that need to be present in any moment for any perception to be had. And what that's saying, in part, is that nothing just exists. Nothing just is by itself, objectively, out there in the world, and you happen to turn your eyes toward and see it, or open your ears and hear it. It's just happening, and you just have an objective experience. The Buddha said, it's not like that. That we are very involved in the creation of what we call our world, what seems to be the world. We don't think of it as our world, my version of the world. I don't experience it that way. I experience it as the world. I don't see myself creating, having a creative, constructive sort of role in it. The Buddha said, everybody has Buddha nature. He didn't actually say that. That came later. The idea of Buddha nature, the Buddha, that came later. But what the Buddha acknowledged in his enlightenment was that everyone has that essence that he came to realize, or that fundamental nature that he came to realize, that is perfect, unsullied, untainted. You cannot lose it. You cannot increase it. It's not a thing, but it is your nature. It is perfect like vast space. And the Buddha taught that we all have kleshas, afflictive emotions, attachments, false views. We cling to the self. The Buddha said that's our strongest tendency. Even through years of practice, even through insights, even through realizations into the emptiness of the self, there's still this very strong muscle, if you will, of self-clinging. Shantideva said, we have Buddha nature, perfect and complete, before you take a step, and we live in the midst of these very strong forces within ourselves. Shantideva said, in samsara, the causes of happiness occur more rarely, whereas the causes of suffering seem to be innumerable. But without suffering, there would be no renunciation. Therefore, mind, be firm. Pay attention. It's not ennobling. It's not enshrining more suffering. It's like the more suffering you have, the more saintly you are. It's not that. The whole point is to free ourselves of suffering by not creating more. But with suffering, with anything that we experience as binding, conflicted, diminishing, destructive, that brings our attention to that, because the Buddha said that is not just happening. It doesn't exist in the world and it just happened to wash up on your shore. It's something that we're actively engaged in. This is a very stark teaching, particularly in a person's life where we have experienced things coming, washing up on our shore that are not good. Just misfortune, bad luck, abuse, injustice. And the Buddha acknowledged that those things are in this world. That is, that's the sign of samsara. That's how we know we're living in samsara, because all that stuff is here. But what the Buddha said is that exists in the world, but how do we experience it? That's what Buddhism is helping us free ourselves, how we experience it. The kleshas are deeply held afflictive emotions. So they're binding by their very nature. Greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy usually make the top five. And then think of aversion as having, you know, a village of aversion. So all the different, you know, beings that live in aversion, impatience, irritations, annoyance, resentment, you know, everything that has a quality. And then greed. There's another village of greed, and then all of the constituent parts of greed. Ignorance, pride, and jealousy. So they're not just one thing. They can appear in many different forms. So the kleshas establish these predispositions, these inclinations, these tendencies. Do you know what I'm talking about? Right? Something happens. You have a tendency to respond in a certain way, an inclination. You don't choose to. You don't decide you're going to. You don't plan ahead. It just happens. It seems to just happen. That's the illusion. That's what we have to see more clearly. But those kleshas become the basis of our action. Sort of sometimes it's spoken of as impulsive consciousness. It's impulsive, right? It's reactive. So think of a recent moment when you saw something or someone, somebody said something to you, or you heard something, and you immediately reacted with irritation, with resentment, with impatience, with anger, right? Shanti Davis says, you didn't decide, okay, I'm going to get angry about this. There's just anger or irritation, or you experience it as offensive. It's impulsive. It's a reaction. Or you see something on the street, jumps out at you. Or on the web, it jumps out at you, something you'd love to have. Oh, that would make me so happy if I had that. So happy. And so in that moment, there's greed. There used to be a student at the monastery who was a novice monastic. She was in discernment. And she would sit down in the dining room and pour through, this is before the web, she'd pour through mail order catalogs, circling things. All the things she wanted, right? And I remember watching her and thinking, I wonder how this is going to work out. Right? Vow of simplicity, not much money. So she ended up getting an inheritance before she had to decide, before she decided to be ordained, and she left. And I said to Dido, we should plan that, right? Before anybody's ordained, they should get a marriage proposal, right? They should get an inheritance, whatever the good stuff might be for them. You see someone who has something, a character trait. They're very funny, they're smart, they're good looking, they're kind. Jealousy. Oh, God. They're very successful. I remember years ago going back to Atlanta to see one of my oldest friends. I'd known her since grade school, and then we'd had a very significant relationship, kind of a first love. And I went back to see her many years later. And it was a very difficult time in my life. I was struggling. I was poor as a church mouse. Life was hard. It was before I came to the monastery. And I went to see her to visit, and she had this beautiful home, this beautiful life. And I got so upset. And I didn't really understand what was going on. And I couldn't be there. I couldn't be with her. I was so upset. And I was unhappy with my life. And it was like she was shoving her life in front of me, which of course she wasn't. And later I wrote to her, I said, I'm so sorry I was such a jerk, right? It had nothing to do with you. I'm just unhappy. And it was hard to be in your happiness. In each moment, these are the kleshas arising. Again, they're not choices. They arise, and there's an energy. It's not just a thought. That's why they're so powerful. It takes over. It infiltrates the body and mind, right? How could that not be true? How could it not be true? If you decided to get angry, and then you get angry and think, oh, maybe that wasn't a good choice. But we didn't decide, and so it seems like it has to be true, that it has to be matching the moment. Somehow it's in accord with what's going on. It's appropriate. And the other reason that it's so difficult is because within that strong emotion, there's a sense of me. I am angry, right? I see something in you that I am not. So the sense of self is very powerful. And so it's hard to see it clearly because it's me. I don't see it as something I'm doing. I see it as something that's happening out there that's happening to me. It's doing something to me. Stop. This is the revolution that has to take place if something is going to change. There's a change in our life, a relationship, a job, something at home, our health, legislation, an election, something that happens that we care very deeply about. We have an investment, and it's not just for us. Maybe it's just for us, but let's think broadly. It's not just for us. Our concern is not just for us, it's for other people. We know other people are going to be affected deeply by this, significantly, maybe badly. We care. Maybe we've worked towards bringing about what we think is the best path forward, and it goes another way. We don't get what we want. We're in the presence of disagreeable people. The Buddha 2,500 years ago said, this is dukkha. It was happening back then too. And so Buddhism is both not prescriptive. It doesn't say, okay, in this situation, do this, right? We could just give you a book at the door. Okay, just look at the index, look at the table of contents, figure out what the situation is, go home. Can't be. One, we would never learn anything. We would never empower ourselves, and we could never predict every situation. So what Buddhism does is introduces us to our mind, to the inner workings of how things work. To study the mind is study Buddha mind. It's also to study our deluded mind. And because mind is universal, you have your particulars based in your life, your experiences, your karma. But mind itself is universal. We're not that different. That's how these teachings can still be so incredibly, stunningly present and relevant. How could the Buddha have known this? Because it's mind. And so we examine this mind. That's why we sit in a zendo, hall of awakening, not a classroom, because it's not about gathering information. So that we can understand the nature of things, how things are work in and of themselves, what they are in and of themselves and what they're not. And then we can live and act and meet our life in that understanding. We have to make our own choices. And then to think that this is happening, these kleshas, these unasked for impulsive responses, reactions, which again are embedded in views, beliefs, deeply held, and are largely invisible to us. You know, the teachings say that, like, if you start smoking, right, you take your first drag, what happens? The body reacts. Like, this is not natural, right? But you keep doing it and the body acclimates. Everything can become a habit, even if it's destructive, right? But we don't see, when did it actually become a habit? There's not a moment. It's so subtle. It just starts to get baked in, but we don't see it. And now when I try and stop, now that's unnatural. Now my body reacts. Delusions are kind of like that. We don't really see it forming. We don't see the attachments forming. We don't see these deeply held inclinations forming. But when we try and go another way, there seems to be resistance, reaction. Sometimes it just feels wrong to not believe that this emotion that I'm feeling is accurate and appropriate. That's why developing right view is the first of the Eightfold Path, to develop an understanding, to build faith. So to think that this is happening in every single person on the planet in virtually every moment of the day, that's samsara. It's kind of a miracle we got this far, right? And I just have to attribute that to our basic goodness. We have enough intelligence, we're enough in contact with reality, we have enough sufficient to like make a go of it. And to create enough positive conditions through intelligence and well-being and compassion and good fortune to like foster enough goodness within us that, you know, here we are. But to think that that's happening so pervasively, again, how do we understand now? And so to cycle through over and over again the arising of something, a desire, I want this, I cling to it, I get it, I lose it because everything is impermanent. I am desiring again. I feel more bereft. It's not working, so I get a little bit more desperate, a little bit more anxious. It's not working, but I try again. And I lose it again, and so I get a little bit more anxiety, and it just keeps amping up. Or something arises that I don't want. So I deny it. I avoid it. I blame it on you. I suppress it. I numb myself. We have lots of ways of responding. But it persists. And then it goes away because everything's impermanent. But now I'm afraid that it's going to happen again. And this continues. This is samsara. This is what the Buddha said will continue. And it is not a path that will lead to peace or fulfillment. It cannot. Because it is based on fundamental false premises, assumptions. And it will continue until it doesn't. Until it shifts. That's the third noble truth. There is dukkha. There is dissatisfaction, disappointment. There is the cause, thirst, a sense of self, wanting. And there's cessation. So when we begin to examine our mind, when we stop and look and see deeply, when we begin to take responsibilities, to take responsibility, which is so important. You know, my teacher used to emphasize this, like talked about taking responsibility, taking responsibility. I thought, I'm a responsible guy. I've been responsible in my life. What are you talking? Why do you keep saying this? I get it. I didn't get it. Not really. I was looking at it in very superficial ways. I didn't understand. And that shift is really shifting the nature of karma. That, because, you know, the, one of the ways of describing it is that when the rain falls, right, on a mountain, rain falls equally everywhere, but it starts to roll down the mountain, but it finds a little indentation. So it rolls towards that because of gravity. And then it trickles from that into another indentation. It sort of winds its way down the mountain till it reaches another stream, and then a river, and then the ocean. And then the sun comes out and it dries. But then it rains again. So the rain falls equally, but it falls into that same groove again. And as it falls, it takes some soil with it, and so that groove gets deeper, and it gets wider. And then it's a little ditch. You can step over it easy, and then it becomes a gully, and you have to jump over. Then it becomes a ravine, and you can't. You have to build a bridge. And if you're in that, in the beginning, you just step out. It's easy. But as time goes on, you can't just step out. It's not so easy. And so it's a way of thinking about how do these things become so deeply held, so set. And so it's important to understand that karma is not a system of reward and punishment. It's really important to understand it's not a social justice instrument, as important as justice is. It's just the way things work. I was talking with a group of, there was a refuge week at the monastery this week, and I was talking to a group of students on Friday, and we were talking about karma, and one of them mentioned a song by Taylor Swift called Karma. I hadn't listened to it yet. And she said, I don't think it's really about karma. So I looked at it, and she said, part of it is, you know, kind of. She said, you're terrified to look down, because if you dare, you'll see the glare of everything, everyone burned just to get there. It's coming back around, right? So I'm afraid to look. I'm afraid to take responsibility. When we sit on the cushion, our life, our karma, the results of our karma, because karma is intentional action, the consequences of that appears within us. We remember things, we feel regret, past and present, it hurts. The Buddha said, use that to help you. Examine, take responsibility, learn, take a vow, make an intention, go another way. But then she goes on to say, karma is my boyfriend, karma is a god, it's the breeze in my hair, it's a cat purring in my lap because it loves me, karma is sweet like justice. It's not. And so when... So when we were talking about it, I said, now I'm going to have to get in arguments about people with people about karma. They say, no, Taylor Swift said it's, you know, whatever. But one of the important things about karma is we can't just will ourselves into action. You know, Buddhism doesn't mention free will. It never talks about that. There's nothing in the teachings that use that term or anything close to it. It recognizes that we don't have absolute freedom. First of all, because I'm a human being, I can't fly. I can't live underwater. I can't even control my mind, right? Just decide you're going to sit and have no thoughts for 30 minutes. Do it, right? We're willful. We can't do it. Will is not enough because those deeply held habitual patterns. So it's not about that, because then we're also just fighting, right? You decide you're going to sit still and not have a thought for 30 minutes, you're going to just crank down on your mind so hard, try and keep those thoughts from coming. That's not peace. And we recognize how when those kleshas are very strong, it's like a little bit like getting intoxicated, right? The more we're in the presence, the stronger those emotions are, the more we are losing control. The less we have access to any other possible responses. You know, it's sort of like when we're clear, or reasonably clear, you can be in a hallway, and there's somewhere you want to be going, right? That's where your intention is. And there are all these doors, and they're open. You could go down that one, you could go down that one. They're all side alleys. Stay on the stay straight ahead, right? And each one you walk by, and they're calling you. There's somebody in there say, hey, come here. I want to tell you something. I got something for you, right? But you keep going, right? Because you have mindfulness. You're grounded. You know you're in your intention, right? You're not controlling, but you have a certain kind of control over what you're doing. But as those kleshas get stronger and stronger, it's like those doors are slamming, right? We have very little choice now. We're losing our control. We're being overwhelmed with ourself, with our mind. And so when you think about when the conditions are part of that, they're stressful, they're frightening, they're unclear, they're uncertain. We don't know what to do. It's not just losing choice. We're losing our clarity. We're losing our capacity to actually see clearly, to know what's happening here. We're becoming distant from here. I can know that I'm angry, but I'm not in touch with the anger. I'm not seeing it. I just know that I'm angry, but the anger's taken over. When you're mindful, when you're aware, when you're practicing anger, you're fully aware of what you're experiencing. You can see it. And because of that, you can make a choice. And so we're both losing clarity, but we're also losing our concern. We're losing our compassion. Things are becoming objects. We are becoming an object to ourselves. And when that begins to happen, kind of all bets are off. When people become objects, when we make somebody into an object, we know what happens. We know what can happen. We know what we're capable of. And so it's not just that we're becoming distracted or that we're very emotional or that we're overwhelmed by a strong emotion, but we're losing some very basic elements, not just of our humanity, but of our wisdom and our capacity to act wisely. And so now to think about that occurring within a relationship, within a group, a larger group, a group has a leader who speaks in such a way that speaks directly to that impulse, to those impulses, and does what Buddhism says we should be most warned about, most cautious about, most alert to. It provides you with an outside cause. It's not you. It's them. It's very easy to get pulled into that. Because it abdicates. It's not me. It's not my fault. And and we've had experiences that are so much like that, just on our own, that it's easy to bring that about. And so that's why the path is a revolution. It says stop. Look. Because when we lose control, the way it appears within a person is that we have gained control. It's like the complete inversion of what's actually happening. Having lost control, not knowing who we are, not knowing our mind, having someone to blame gives us a sense of being in control. And in that way, it doesn't have to be wild. It doesn't have to be emotionally volatile. It can be very cold and rational and calculated. In a way, that's the most frightening form because it is so cut off, right? For us to hurt ourselves or another, we have to cut something off. That's why the more we come back home, return to our basic nature, into our mind, or we open our hearts, it's naturally compassion arises, right? But we also have to encourage it. And so when these ongoing past patterns of interaction have been developing, and they're being manufactured skillfully through all kinds of influences, it's very easy to be drawn into that, right? I am suffering. I don't want it to keep happening. I do want to know why it's happening. And somebody comes and says, I'll tell you why it's happening. This is why it's happening. This is who is making this happen. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, you can't abdicate responsibility. Not in fact. In our minds, we can. It's not my fault. But that's just trickery. So that we are responsible, that's the teaching of karma. That the consequences of my actions are inescapable. Right. And if I don't see those consequences now, they will happen in time. It might take a long time, but they're inescapable. And so that's part of the basis for compassion in Buddhism, is that when we see people acting badly, we can know that they are acting out of their own deep cut-offness, their own alienation, their own lack of understanding, their own incapacity to be within themselves. As one teacher said, they don't know what to do with what they're experiencing inside of themselves. The easiest thing to do is externalize it. And so we can see that, and we don't have to know much, but just see their actions and know that that's happening, because that has to be happening in order for a person to actively be wanting to cause harm to others. They're not just cut off from other people, they're cut off from themselves. But they're still responsible. Ignorance is not bliss. Ever. The Buddha said, suffering is never appeased by more hatred, or hatred is never appeased by more hatred. By compassion alone are they appeased. This is an eternal law. Conflict is never appeased by more conflict. Suffering is never appeased by more suffering. But that doesn't mean that conflict can't be appeased by skillful meeting that conflict. But when we meet it with the same stuff, the anger, the hatred, the desire for revenge, the diminishment of the enemy, making them an enemy. Does everything have to be a fight? When I watched Kamala's concession speech, and she used fight. We have to fight. We have to keep fighting. We have to keep fighting. I said, can't we come up with another way of thinking about this? Because even if it's a fight for good, we're still fighting. Can't we create another paradigm? Language does matter. Every view, even those based in compassion, are fragile when self-clinging is present. Every view arises from the mind. And in a sense, it accords with the reality that I am creating. That's why when we sit, we try and practice not creating. You don't let go of one thought and generate another one, a better one, an enlightened one. We try and let go of creating so that we can see, what does reality say? Right? You cannot believe in gravity, but if you jump out of a tree, gravity will come to meet you. Right? We cannot believe in attachments. I cherish my attachments. Yeah, well, that is true. But I believe in them. They work. Pay attention. Watch. Is that true? Don't just believe what the Buddha said, what Buddhism teaches. See if it's true. And so we sit to face the Creator, this mind, this world, and we try and calm, genuinely calm, not by suppressing it, by allowing it to calm the impulse to deny, to avoid, to suppress, to distract, to cling, to proliferate, to see all people as having Buddha nature and acting from their karma and their conditions can be a way of grounding ourselves and looking and seeing the person. We see the action. We also have to see the person, to see the conditions of mind, of emotion, of history, of belief, of present circumstances. Human sciences, psychological sciences, natural sciences offer all kinds of insight. There's so many people, very intelligent people, smart people who know a great deal about their own fields of study, who are talking about what is going on now. There's a lot to learn from that. But the Buddha said there's fundamentally a fundamental that if we don't really gain insight to that, all of those other fields of study will help to a point. Because ultimately, we always meet ourselves. And we meet ourselves in ourselves, and we meet ourselves in each other. And that's the radical nature of Buddhist practice, is within the midst of so much activity that we would gather here, or that you would devote some time each day to not producing, not creating, not gathering more information, not figuring things out, but examining at the deepest level possible, and never put a wall or a boundary around what that is. Don't ever think you know what the limit of the knowable is. Because in that work, we meet our kleshas. We meet the results of our karma. We see how it is still functioning. We see how hard it is, even in the best of circumstances. And I would say, it's hard to beat this. Even in the best of circumstances, how difficult it is. So think about in the worst of conditions, or when those conditions are encouraging all of those deep, habitual impulses. If something can be remedied, why be unhappy? Just be skillful and working towards that. If there is no remedy, there's no point in being unhappy. It can be difficult to cultivate joy, to cultivate happiness, to cultivate a lightness of being when you live with or in the presence of or know about so many people who are suffering. I get that. I left the South because of that. I didn't know how to hold my awareness of the suffering that I was in the midst of and that I was part of historically. So I thought, I'll just get away from it. Well, you know how that goes. It doesn't work. And so, but to recognize, just on a rational level, when I am constructing and actively involved in feeling terrible, miserable about what is happening for you or somebody else, am I helping you? Just a simple question. Pretty easy to answer. Am I helping myself? Pretty easy to answer. But it can just feel wrong to let go of actively holding that when I know that you are in so much pain or that you are in the midst of something that is so frightening. But there is a very deeply rational aspect of Buddhist practice. It's not just a teaching, it's apply that and see. See what works, towards what end, causing no harm, actualizing good for others. We see that those who are creating harm act out of their own causing conditions. We see this within ourselves. And we see that there's no true happiness, no true happiness. We can take actions to help ourselves and our world in the direction of kindness and compassion. And we can do that every single day. Every single day. In any and every interaction. That's the life of the Bodhisattva. You wake up in the morning and you establish that intention. You go out of your house, your apartment, wherever you live, with that in mind. How can I help? How can I serve? What do you need? What is needed? It's a very different way of going out the door. You've got your list to do. You've got that. You know that. We don't need to hold that here. It's more going out with a heart that's open and like, how can I serve? Because in every opportunity, that becomes a guiding principle. It's a way of being in the world. And we can be diligent in weakening and dissolving those impulses that arise that hinder that, obstruct that, discourage that. I wanted to mention before I close that Hojin Sensei and I have been talking, and in the next, we don't know quite when, we haven't set a date, we're going to have an abbot installation for Hojin Sensei here. Many of you may not even know this, but formally, technically speaking, when an abbot is established in a place of training, and there are criteria for that within our tradition, there has to be a place, right? It can't be a transient place. It has to be a place that is grounded, that has roots. In this sense, in a practical way, we own this, right? We own this piece of property. We have established a temple. And so an abbot is installed. And so originally I had Dada Roshi, and then Myotai Sensei, and then I stepped into that role, and technically I am still in that role, even though Hojin Sensei has been so beautifully and wonderfully fulfilling that role all of these years that she's been here. So acting as abbot. But now it's time to do that more formally. And there's a aspect of that where I step down, call it descending the mountain, and Hojin steps up, ascending the mountain being the temple. And so we're working it out, and we'll have a time, and this will be the place, and we'll let you know. So I just want to let you know of that. That's something that we're looking forward to. Well deserved. And then I'll just end with a poem. This blessed world, a symphony of miracles, a cacophony of madness. No, not madness, but the sound of those who have not yet touched their own heart of being, have not yet had subtle communication beyond words with their bright, clear Buddha mind. And you? Let us walk together for as long as we have breath and bring life. Who could ever believe that tulips will bloom again after winter's harshest cold? And yet. And you? Thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.